This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrick. Coming up, we'll talk to two youth mental health experts about the importance of household gun safety and how some simple steps can lead to a safer home. Now, health insurance enrollment through the Affordable Care Act marketplaces is up 21% from a year ago. That number is likely higher as the final numbers aren't out yet. When he took office a year into the pandemic, President Biden enacted policies that would make it easier to sign up for health insurance through the ACA. For example, giving people more time to sign up. We're talking about this jump in ACA marketplace enrollment that happened this year and what it means. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you sign up for healthcare through the Affordable Care Act this year? Have you used this in the past? Did you use the extra time you had to make that sign up? Do you have questions about how it all works and who it serves? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Coleman Drake is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of Pittsburgh, Graduate School of Public Health. Coleman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Before we dig into these numbers, Coleman, can you remind us what this marketplace is and who it's intended to serve?
Sure. So we're talking about healthcare.gov. This is the health insurance marketplace created under the 2010 Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. Now, that law had a lot of other important components to it, most notably the Medicaid expansion that has been adopted by most states. The Wisconsin is not one of them. But a big part of it also is healthcare.gov and these marketplaces that are used in other states, which now are a source of insurance for around 15 million people. About what has been 8 years since it was enacted at the start of 2014. And the idea here is to provide a internet platform where people can go to compare and shop for health insurance plans and, depending on their incomes, receive subsidies to purchase those health insurance plans.
What do you see driving this large number of enrollees, people who enrolled for coverage in 2022?
Well, I think there's really kind of five different factors, though they are all related to recent policy changes and the Biden administration's approach to the Affordable Care Act. First and foremost, I would say that the enhanced subsidies offered by the American Rescue Plan really made a difference. We went from a world where health insurance plans were deeply discounted for customers, but now we're in a world where not only are they deeply discounted for a lot of people, they are free or nearly free. Another big bit was that the Biden administration had a extended enrollment period that went on through much of 2021, providing an outlet for people that were having gaps in health insurance to sign up and receive coverage through the marketplaces. Let's see. I'd also point out open enrollment was extended into January. People are paying more attention to health insurance coverage, perhaps because of COVID. And the administration has just made a priority out of making people aware of their health insurance options through the marketplace and elsewhere. So we saw in the previous administration, there was sort of a substantial decrease in health insurance coverage programs. When that administration took power, and then as the Biden administration has taken power and done a lot of outreach, enrollment has gone back up quite a bit. So number of related factors.
Big picture in this 8 years since the act came into place, this particular element of it, these marketplaces, how much of a difference have they made in the overall number of Americans who have some kind of health care coverage?
Yeah. So like I said, there's, and I think you said at the start of the program too, there's about 15 million people that are covered through the marketplaces right now. And I think the way to answer that question kind of in a contemporary, and by contemporary, I mean post or intra-COVID setting, is that these marketplaces have provided a sort of cushion for a lot of people that perhaps didn't had unstable access to health insurance as a result of the pandemic, and have also provided insurance to people that some that didn't have it and some that had insurance that might have not had as good of benefits as we would have seen prior to the Affordable Care Act. So Every plan sold on the marketplaces has what's called essential health benefits, which means that you can expect them to cover things like preventive health services and visits to the hospital and substance use disorder treatment that wasn't always covered under older health insurance plans.
As you mentioned, the COVID pandemic led to some of these policy changes from the Biden administration and investments in a relief bill. Do you see just raising awareness of the need for healthcare being driven by this pandemic? Maybe that's an incentive for people who might have been on the fence earlier.
Yeah. So like you said, there's kind of these two interacting forces here, which one is just with the COVID pandemic being out there. It's kind of hard to validate this with research so far, but it stands to reason that a lot of people might have said to themselves, well, this might not be the best time to be going without health insurance. And that by itself could drive interest in health insurance options, including the marketplaces and Medicaid. But also, like you said, the administration had its extended open enrollment period last year as a result of the pandemic. So that certainly enabled some of those people that could have been searching for health insurance options to take advantage of them.
Talking to Coleman Trake, assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public Health, looking at the Affordable Care Act and a jump in enrollments in the Affordable Care Act marketplace coming into 2022. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question about the marketplace and how it works. If you have an experience with it, for better or worse, let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Diane in Emerald, who couldn't stay on the line, but she says she was on Obamacare for a short time. The coverage was fine, she says, but she came into some money mid-year that she wasn't expecting, so she wound up taking a tax hit at the end of it. Do things get complicated if our eligibility changes midway through a year, Coleman?
Yeah, so when one's income changes particularly significantly, that can affect the size of the subsidy that that someone receives. So, for example, let's see, if your income is below about 150% of the federal poverty level, about $18,000, you can sign up for kind of a standard plan on the marketplaces literally for free. But if your income were to double, it could cost a few hundred dollars a month, literally about around $200. So if someone does have a, inheritance or something of the sort that comes halfway through the year, that could result in tax implications. Now, that being said, you can call up your health insurer and healthcare.gov if that kind of thing happens to you, and figure out what your adjusted premium is going to be at the time. If you don't do that, it will be reconciled on your taxes next year. But this also has an upside. If people experience a significant decrease in income during the year, their subsidy will increase, and they should take advantage of that. The subsidies are very much dependent on income, and people should be cognizant.
One question at various points, especially the earlier years of the Affordable Care Act, was would people have options in different parts of the country to care plans under these marketplaces? There are concerns that, this place might just have two options. This place might have one. Maybe there wouldn't even be one. How has that shaken out since that was, it seemed like a larger concern?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And, I've been knee deep in the research since the start. And it's just been such a turnaround. I remember 2015, 2017, mm-hmm. or not 2015 so much, but 2017, 18, and 19. You had a lot of particularly rural states to the west of Wisconsin, but even some parts of Wisconsin, I believe, that were you only had a single insurer to choose from on the marketplaces. And that was particularly bad for people whose incomes were above the subsidy cap. Now, that subsidy cap is gone, so not so much of an issue there. But also the issue is largely gone because insurers have been jumping into these marketplaces for the last couple of years to the point that they're in a lot of places more competitive now than they've ever been. The entire state of Nebraska now has four insurers competing in the marketplaces, and Wisconsin competition is up quite a bit as well. So really just a sea change there where this is just not a... not an issue that we're really seeing states very concerned about anymore.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Bill is with us in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. So I was on Obamacare for a couple of different years, which worked out fantastic for me because I was able to find a great plan. It had a $2,000 max out of pocket. I have epilepsy. I have type 1 diabetes. So, okay, I had to pay a fair amount up front. But once I hit that with the pumps and everything, 100% coverage. Well, now I got on disability. I was automatically enrolled on Medicare. So instead of $8,000, which was pretty high, I paid $13,000 last year. Medicare this year just tripled my insulin cost. It won't let me get my seizure meds without a fight. Medicare, for all, is ridiculous. The Obamacare was just fantastic. I did have to pay a penalty briefly 1 year because I estimated my income incorrectly, but it was just fantastic for me.
Interesting. Bill, thanks so much for sharing that story. Sorry about those high costs, especially of the insulin material. Coleman, that's not how it's supposed to work in some ways, right? People, if they go from Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, sorry, to Medicare, do we expect them to take a hit like Bill is talking about?
Well, it depends. If you were getting a really beneficial, really generous plan through healthcare.gov, that is, it's really kind of hard to find insurance that's better than that, especially at the, you know, if you're making $15,000 a year, the generosity of the health insurance coverage you can get on healthcare.gov is just fantastic. So I can absolutely, it's not surprising to me to hear that it transitioned from maybe one of those types of plans to Medicare could well result in more cost exposure.
Bill, thanks a lot for sharing your experience with us. Coleman Drake is with us, assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of Pittsburgh. We're talking to him about the record number of signups in the last Affordable Care Act open enrollment period, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you signed up for insurance through healthcare.gov in the last year or the last few years? We want to hear from you. Why did you sign up? What do you like about it? What parts of it were more trouble for you maybe than you think they were worth? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the increase in health insurance enrollments through government marketplaces in the last year. Coleman Drake is with us, assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of Pittsburgh. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, your experiences with the Affordable Care Act, especially these marketplaces. You can call in at 800-642-1234 if you have a healthcare.gov experience to share. That's 800-642-1234. Coleman, we heard from Sue in Little Hope, who asks, what is the cost of Obamacare to the taxpayer? How does it compare to the original estimates when it was first passed? Well, it's a massive question. What do we know about that, Coleman?
Yeah, sure thing. So let me try and answer this. So this is a kind of, you could have a very long conversation on
right.
the subject. So the original Affordable Care Act came in, I believe, around, it was passed in 2010. Estimates were around $1 trillion for the past decade. That being said, there was a lot else going on in there besides the marketplaces. Mm-hmm. Again, Medicaid expansion, various kinds of changes to payment models, things like that. So what we're looking at essentially going forward, and I think the relevant number kind of for budgetary discussions is the Biden administration is facing this decision along with Congress to extend the additional subsidies associated with the American Rescue Plan. And the Congressional Budget Office has estimated that the cost of doing that for this decade is going to be $74 billion or $7.4 billion per year. So that's the overall cost. When I bring up those numbers, I like to mention to people that the kind of frame of comparison is employer-sponsored insurance. One could do a comparison to Medicaid, but Medicaid insurers get paid a lot less than the marketplace or the employer-sponsored insurance insurers do. So broadly speaking, marketplace insurance is roughly as expensive to provide as giving a person insurance through their job. And the reason for that is that in the marketplaces, you get a subsidy to purchase health insurance. And if your employer provides you health insurance, they provide you with, rather, they get a tax exclusion to provide health insurance to you. So to elaborate on that a little bit, if you're paid a dollar by your employer, you might only see about 80 cents of that in wages, depending on where you sit with your tax rate. But if they spend a dollar on your health insurance, they will spend literally, you will get a dollar of it because that's entirely tax exempt. So as a result of this setup, providing health insurance through employers ends up being very costly for the federal government. In fact, it's the single biggest line item in the federal budget. So to be, I guess, to wrap that up and to summarize, providing insurance through healthcare.gov or the marketplaces per person is roughly around as expensive as what we're dealing with to provide insurance to people through how we most commonly do for non-elderly adults, employer-sponsored insurance.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Kent is with us in Monona. Kent, hi.
Hey, Rob. I just wanted to share that a couple years ago, I had to have a surgery. It was a minor surgery, and had every complication in the book from it. I was unable to work for the last couple of years between that and the pandemic, and the marketplace really got me a really good insurance plan. I had 9 surgeries over the last 2 years to fix the issues, and I would be in the hole about $200,000 right now if it wasn't for the marketplace, which had, I got a $3,000 out-of-pocket max, and then everything else was 100% covered. And when the rescue plan kicked in, I actually got a credit back to me for the subsidies and whatnot.
Kent, thanks for sharing that story. Sorry about the what sounds like a medical nightmare. I'm glad it wasn't also a financial nightmare for you. Coleman, Kent's story is one of the goals of the Affordable Care Act in the first place, right? Making sure that a situation where somebody has to have, as in Kent's case, lots of surgeries doesn't end up financially ruined for life afterward.
Yeah, I think that absolutely. I'm glad to hear it worked out so well for Kent, at least on the financial side.
Right.
The context of the passage of the Affordable Care Act was very much the financial crisis now over a decade behind us. But you might remember uninsured rates were approaching 20% at a time when many families were experiencing other financial hardships to boot. And I remember a speech I heard Rep. John Yarmuth from Kentucky talking about, we saw those uninsured rates creeping up and we felt we needed to do something about it. So the impetus was very much to try and provide people with a source of health insurance that they could rely on, even if they were experiencing some either coming down with some health conditions that or uncertainty in their labor market and what's going on with their jobs, but also to provide health insurance to people who maybe didn't work for a large employer or didn't have or just weren't getting a good offer of health insurance from their employers, so they could still have access to subsidized health insurance in a similar way to people who get insurance through their employer, but to be able to not have to deal with job-related uncertainty or just jobs that don't provide access to health insurance. So, yeah, I think that's exactly how the law was supposed to work.
Thanks again for calling in, Kent. We're talking to Coleman Drake from the University of Pittsburgh, expert on health policy, looking at the Affordable Care Act. Coleman, there have been some kind of up and down all or nothing debates on the Affordable Care Act, efforts to repeal it a few years back. You've written about some changes, some tweaks you'd like to see to the Affordable Care Act over the last few years. What kind of things are top of mind for you?
Well, I think the biggest thing by far right now is the continuation of the subsidies from the American Rescue Plan. I think shortly after the law went into effect, it became clear that the subsidies needed to be a bit larger to really provide the kind of access that the framers of the law were hoping for. And that's been affected under the American Rescue Plan. So I like to see how affordable things are right now, and I'd like to see that continue. I'm just pausing for a moment here. I'd like to see that continue. And the other concern with now that these subsidies have been temporarily implemented is that if they aren't extended, people could then see their premiums revert to what they were prior to the American Rescue Plan. And that could put people in an unfortunate situation where this time next year, they're seeing that their health insurance premiums have increased substantially. And that could be particularly problematic for people that have $0 premiums right now, who don't have to do anything month to month to keep their health insurance. They would then need to go back on the line and set up a recurring credit card payment or send checks in the mail on a monthly basis. And I'd be worried that people might not be aware that that change is coming and could end up being uninsured. So by far and above, that's what I'd like to see change with the law. The other thing I think is that there was a really successful policy in Massachusetts back when they had their kind of precursor to the Affordable Care Act, which has been dubbed Romney Care because Mitt Romney was the governor when that law was passed. And what they did was they changed things. So when people didn't meet their monthly payment a few months in a row, just forgot or were having difficulties getting the payment out or whatever, rather than make the person lose their insurance and become uninsured, they were automatically switched to a plan with a $0 premium. And what that accomplished is maybe their coverage generosity went down, but then they weren't completely, they didn't go from being generously insured to completely uninsured overnight. And I think I'd like to see some changes affected to that extent in the marketplaces as well. It was very successful at keeping people insured.
Coleman, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Coleman Drake is an assistant professor in the Department of Health, Policy, and Management at the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public Health. He talked to us today about an increase in enrollment for coverage under the Affordable Care Act marketplace, a record coming into 2022. Still time for you to share your experiences. If you've looked at getting coverage at healthcare.gov, did you end up getting it? What steered you away from it if you didn't? What was your experience like under that kind of coverage? Are you one of the people who joined up maybe for the first time coming into this year? You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, kick off a series of interviews with candidates for mayor of Wisconsin's largest city. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the pandemic caused Wisconsin nonprofit groups in several sectors to rethink the way they operate. A Wisconsin reporter tells us why some of those changes may stick around. Now, about 44% of households in the U.S. have a gun in the home, according to polling from Gallup. So if your household is one of them, how can you make sure your gun is stored safely? And what should gun safety conversations with your kids sound like? Those are questions our next guests have been thinking about. They say we can set aside some divisive conversations around gun policy in the U.S. and take practical steps to keep guns out of reach for kids. Dr. Emily Ray is a child and adolescent psychiatrist with Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Dr. Ray, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Greg Head is a child and adolescent therapist, also with Gunderson Health System. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. We at Gunderson want to thank you for highlighting this issue.
And Dr. Ray, can you tell us a little more about why you wanted to start talking about the issue of gun safety for kids?
Well, there are several reasons. I mean, in my job, I work with adolescents on an inpatient behavioral health unit. And so one of our big focuses is preventing suicide. And then, of course, the other reason is just the headlines that, you know, occasionally, unfortunately, we hear about school shootings. So these are issues that really touch on all of us, and I think it's an important message to talk about gun safety.
And Greg, the pandemic has been really hard on youth mental health. There were concerns about youth mental health even before the pandemic started. Can you talk about why that's an important part of this conversation?
Well, really, just a lot of unexpected things have been occurring, and we're seeing behaviors from teenagers that we really had never seen before. We have some early preliminary research that talks about their isolation and a lot of the stress from schooling and just the ongoing nature of managing the pandemic. But But we are seeing things that we've never seen before, which makes us as child safety professionals think about being even more vigilant and being safe, especially with firearms.
Dr. Ray, as parents, I don't know, can we make wrong assumptions about how our kids will act when we have guns in the house?
I think that we probably, there is danger of that. I think that we might assume that since kids took a hunter safety course that they'll know, not to touch that gun. I think we might assume it with our teenagers because most of the time they seem very stable, that they're never going to have a bad day and make an impulsive choice with a gun. So I think we need to be vigilant always when we have a gun in our house.
Greg, I understand you're a gun owner yourself. What are some of the basic safety tips you would hope, especially parents, keep in mind with a gun in the house?
Well, as the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends, obviously the best, most safe way to protect a child from being involved in accidental shooting is to not keep one's firearms in the same location where a child resides, and for them to avoid visiting a home where a firearm is located. However, if storing your sporting arms is in another location is not viable, there are lots of options available nowadays for securing firearms, Rob.
Yeah, what are some of those things people could do, assuming that they want to keep the firearm in their house? What are some of the more accessible precautions they can take?
Well, first off, firearms should always be unloaded when not in use, and they should always be stored unloaded. Ammunition should be stored in a locked location separate from your firearms. One of the most readily available and affordable gun locks happens to be one of the most effective, and that's the cable lock, which ranges in price from $10 to $50 and is often based, it's often even available free of charge at certain community service agencies. But this is a very effective way of securing firearms. The cable runs through the barrel or action of the firearm to prevent it from being accidentally fired, and it requires a key or a combination to unlock it. And if one secures that key or that combination, it is a relatively safe way of keeping your firearm stored safely.
Dr. Ray, if there's a child in the home who's being careless around firearms, what would you want to hear from a parent? What kind of things can they do to intervene?
Well, I think if there's a child that's being careless around firearms, I think that you just need to make sure that child has absolutely no access to firearms. And if, say, your child was out with you hunting and they were being careless, I think most parents would say, okay, I'm sorry, you're not going to be able to get to use this again, for a period of time until I know you can be safe with it.
Greg, let's talk about guns. When should parents start talking to kids about gun safety if there's a gun around in particular? What kind of conversations do you want to see happen?
Rob, I'm so glad you asked that, because really these conversations need to start fairly early on. Whether you choose to have guns in your home or not, please be sure to talk to your kids about guns. Children need to know that guns are very dangerous. Teach your children to follow certain rules if they see a gun. For example, children should stop what they are doing immediately if they were to see a gun. Children should never touch a gun or allow anyone else to touch a gun, even if it looks like a toy, and emphasize that, even if it looks like a toy. They should then immediately leave the area where the gun is, and please, after that, tell a trusted adult right away.
Dr. Ray, let's go to the teenagers now. You mentioned earlier, how does their cognitive development impact their decision-making when it comes to firearms?
Well, we know that our brains are developing, even into our 20s, and especially in teenagers, their frontal lobes aren't as developed as somebody who's, in their 30s. So part of what that means is that they're going to be more impulsive and they're going to be more in the moment. So I think it's even more critical when you have a teenager around to keep the guns stored safely.
Greg, are you hoping to start a conversation around these issues, especially again for those parents?
Absolutely, because every responsible firearm owner that I know is just as concerned about this as every other parent. And so if we can get beyond some of the politics and talk about the fact that we have guns in our community, how do we keep our children safe? I think that is the most important thing.
And Dr. Ray, as we wrap up, for that parent who might find themselves concerned that their child of whatever age might seek to harm themselves, what recommendations can you leave us with?
Well, I think certainly if you have concerns for your child that they may harm themselves, you can either go directly to an emergency room, you can call your child's pediatrician or primary care provider, you can call the National Suicide Hotline. There's many avenues, but I think just don't ignore it. Take it seriously.
Thanks for joining us, Dr. Ray.
Thank you.
And Greg, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Dr. Emily Ray and Greg Head. They both work in child and adolescent psychiatry at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. They are with us today to talk about how to practice household gun safety and how to start a conversation about issues related to gun safety with your kids. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about a woman setting the record straight on history.
Joyce Alter Johnson has loved history her entire life. But as a descendant of slaves, her family history, like the history of many Black families across the country, was largely struck from the historical record. Johnson had to take it upon herself to uncover her family's roots. WPR's Christine Hatfield brings you her story.
Who we are is determined by where we come from, our parents, where they come from, their parents, where their parents come from, and a chain of unbreakable links that could explain not only our genetic makeup, but also our personalities.
Joyce Salter Johnson's love of history started with a missing link in her family's history. She says her grandmother appeared to have no roots at all. She essentially lived alone in a nice house in the South that her grandfather sent money home to build while he worked on the Illinois Central Railroad. Johnson has always been a storyteller, and the holes in her family's history left room for her curiosity to thrive. When she reached adulthood, that curiosity transformed from fantasy into research. It took years to get answers to her family's story.
Before 1866, there was nothing written in any archive about slaves. Nothing. The information that you needed to find out about the enslaved person was in the archives or the databases or the journals of the people that held them enslaved.
Eventually, she traced the Salters back to 1792, when Hardy Salter was born to enslaved parents in Virginia. The journey of the Salters took them to Good Hope, Mississippi. That's where Joyce Salter Johnson grew up. Over the years, life led Johnson to Freeport, Illinois, and eventually Madison, where she's lived for more than 30 years. But it was Freeport's Historical Society that inspired Joyce's next historical endeavor.
So for years, we would always get these really nice publications about Freeport. And often it was a historic publication about Freeport. And there was never, ever one picture of any African American in those publications.
When she asked why, she was told there weren't records of African Americans living there, let alone pictures. So she began combing through the historical records herself, finding stories of centuries worth of Black settlers in the county.
In order for history to be accurate, it must present an inclusive record of all people. Unfortunately, in the past, a substantial portion of the history of the Negro in Stevenson County has been omitted. This omission has allowed generations of the county's residents, both Black and white, to grow up with a distorted view of Stevenson County and the roles African American have played in its development. And that's what I had to give to them, and they said, of course we'll publish your book. I place people of African descent in that time and place, in that space, where they should have been automatically put in that space.
Johnson says she's glad to see her books as more than just family history. She says they're textbooks people can learn from. As for herself, life has carried on through the years of research and hard work. She found her way into early childhood education and led Madison's Early Childhood Learning Center, taking in children who needed extra care. At 82, her work isn't done just yet. She still has another book to write and more history to share with the world.
Joy Salter Johnson is the author of numerous historical books. WPR's Christine Hatfield brought you her story. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll find out how nonprofits here in Wisconsin have had to pivot during the pandemic to meet the changing needs of the people they help. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new series from Madison 365 is looking at a lot of different ways the pandemic has changed people's lives in Wisconsin. The series is called Lasting Impacts, and the first piece looks at nonprofit groups that had to pivot from their normal operations. Robert Chappell is executive editor of 365 Media Foundation. His recent piece for Madison 365 is called A Cultural Shift. Nonprofits see lasting changes, some subtle, some seismic, coming out of the pandemic. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. How are you?
Well, good. Now, you talk to people in the nonprofit world in Madison, mm-hmm. Dade County, Greater Green Bay area, Appleton. What led you to want to explore how the pandemic had influenced these nonprofit groups?
Well, we kind of put the question out there last year. We did a series in cooperation with the Wausau Pilot and Herald, and we actually came on your show and talked about that, the mm-hmm. lasting impacts of the pandemic on incarceration. And that was just such a fascinating thing that there are things that are being done differently now in the prison and jail system that could have been done differently all along, right? And they're just decided to do things differently now because of the pandemic, and some of those changes will stick. And we thought that was just really fascinating. And we started thinking about what other systems, institutions, day-to-day life things are going to just be different now, even, you know, cross your fingers that there will be a post-pandemic time eventually. But, you know, what is it about our daily lives is going to be different now that we're going to look back 5 years from now and say, oh, we did that differently now because of the pandemic. So we started to think about different, different areas of life that we know will have been impacted. And we wanted to tackle nonprofits first because, you know, we are a nonprofit news outlet. We're very deeply involved with the nonprofit community here in Madison, as well as around the state. And we just saw really, really quickly how the nonprofit sector addressed the pandemic needs, the immediate needs of the pandemic very early on, back in like March and April of 2020. So I just thought we should check in with them and talk about, you know, in the last year and a half, almost 2 years now, how have things changed for you, and which of those changes are going to stick?
Yeah, what were some of the biggest changes with mm-hmm. the, for many, sudden pivot to a very different set of needs?
Well, the first most apparent one is that nonprofit organizations started to do things that they'd never done before using the infrastructure they have in place, right? A good nonprofit has a network of contacts in a community, has an infrastructure to deliver services, and some of them just had to pivot to deliver different services. Like you had Literacy Network, which normally does, you know, English language learning, and they are now, so they've got this pot of this group of people that they serve, and now they're giving them not only literacy skills but gas cards and grocery store gift cards and things like that to help them get through that really difficult time. You have the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County suddenly becoming a mask distribution organization. They're normally doing after school care, education support, and now they've distributed 2.5 million face masks. You know, it's just they know how to deliver services. They're just delivering different services. But then you also had a whole other sector of nonprofits in like the arts, for example, who kind of shut down completely and took several months to sort of reflect and be introspective and think about how they're going to do things differently in the future. And we're actually going to explore that in a later piece in the series. We're just going to look specifically at arts and culture.
What are some of the things, obviously, well, hopefully a group won't have to give out masks forever. What kind of changes did you see in their operations that they think, yeah, this might be a model. Maybe we should have been doing this all along.
I think the biggest thing on the nonprofit side from that, and we'll talk about the funding side also, there's some permanent changes on the funding side, I think. But the biggest thing on the nonprofit side is collaboration. You have up in Appleton, you had a group of nonprofits that got together early in the pandemic to form the Multicultural Communications Committee, which basically just understanding that people needed to be informed. People needed information, and there are pockets and smallish communities all over the state, but you know, Fox Valley as well, that maybe don't speak English as a first language, don't engage with mainstream media, maybe won't trust the county coming to them. So they figured out, how can we reach these constituencies? These are our people that we work with every day. How can we get this information to their hands? And then they did that, and they were successful doing that. And a year later, now there are vaccines available. So they pivoted from communication to creating vaccine pop-ups, right? And they're doing this as a collaboration of different groups. And what's happening now is all those groups are actually getting together to form a brand new group. There's a whole new nonprofit up there called the Multicultural Coalition Incorporated. They've applied for 501c3 status. In fact, they may have already gotten it by now. This is a few weeks ago now that they said that they had applied for it. They're doing some funding to hire staff, and they're going to continue to do that collaborative work to address other equity issues in literacy, in transportation, in employment, and education disparities. So, and the collaboration part was really key for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's this, anybody in the nonprofit world knows, like, you end up competing for money, right? There's government grants, there's foundation grants, and you're kind of fighting over scraps. But if you come together, you can all have a piece of the pie and you can all do your work by sharing resources. But also, they were able to bring the really important issues of those marginalized communities to greater attention. Like, they were getting meetings with the governor. They were getting meetings with the DHS secretary that an individual organization may not have been able to get that attention, but coming together, they're able to like raise the issues up and get more attention and more state resources as well.
You mentioned changes also in the way these things are funded and way fundraising mm-hmm. is done. Can you spend a minute or so talking about that?
Sure. Yeah. On the foundation side, I talked with the Greater Green Bay Community Foundation, and this is also reflected in my conversations with the Madison Community Foundation as well. But that funding just got more flexible, right? They've been talking for years about trying to make it easier for nonprofits to access funding. So in Green Bay, they were able to take their normal like 15-page grant applications, get it down to one page, just for expeditious purposes. And now they're finding out, oh, wait, we actually didn't really need those other 14 pages, right? They're meeting more frequently to get funding decisions made more quickly, and we could continue to do this. And also on the reporting side, you know, if you get a grant for $10,000, you spend the $10,000, then you got to write a 20-page report about what you did with the $10,000. They're getting rid of that, and they're just having a phone conversation. But how did it go? Were we able to meet your needs? What other needs do you have? And that's a much more interactive and much more just a much more productive way to look at what else needs to happen.
And you also wrote about in-person fundraising, that big annual event or whatever. Yeah. People can do that in person. Are those maybe going to go away?
Maybe. I think, you know, they're finding out maybe you don't need to do a silent auction for everything. Maybe it's that people actually want to give you money to support your cause, not to dress up and be fancy. So those fundraisers events, you know, might continue to be fun and stuff, but they're seeming less absolutely necessary.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Thanks for having me, Rob. I appreciate it.
Talking to Robert Chappell, Executive Director of 365 Media Foundation. We talked to him about his recent piece for the Madison 365 year-long series called Lasting Impact, looking at the pandemic and its impact on nonprofit organizations. If you have a story to share, if you work with a nonprofit, if you run one, if you receive services for one, what kind of things changed for you during the pandemic? Did you learn lessons maybe that will stick around after the pandemic? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, why do we accumulate so much stuff over the course of our lives? We'll sort things out with the author of a new book called Clutter, An Untidy History. And we'll ask you to share your stories and thoughts along the way. And Wisconsin has an unexpected budget surplus, but it's not clear what the state is going to do with it. We'll check out the options and the debates, and you could share your ideas and suggestions. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll get the latest on resettlement efforts here in Wisconsin for people who fled Taliban rule in Afghanistan as part of a big new project from WPR and PBS Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.